I kind of had a choice at that point.
Not just being patient with the process, but being grateful with the process.
And I'm like, man, I went to my dad straight after the game. I'm like, yo, like this shit can't happen anymore, man. I always try to take the good out of any negative situation.
You know, I have players coming in, Xavier, and they'd be like, you know, I played so bad. You know, sometimes I'd be like, hey, bro, hey, I don't know, we can't do nothing about that. I can tell you what we can do, we can get some work in right now.
Like, if you're not doing plyometrics, you're losing out on a lot of potential for performance.
My dad had these tapes of the Laker game. I got to a point where I said, you know, I want to play basketball. And I just always wanted to make sure I had the edge over people.
It became a part of me, you know, I didn't want anybody to get to be better than me.
This episode is brought to you by Whoop. Whoop is the only 24/7 wearable technology that measures the everyday stressors both inside and outside of work and training. Whoop measures the physiological data related to sleep, including the quality, duration, and consistency of sleep, strain, which is the internal load from external stress, and recovery, which is the readiness to perform. Whoop uses these three key metrics to call out areas for improvements and reinforce positive habits. If you're looking to join the team, use my discount code BBALL at checkout or just click the link in my description to get a free 30-day trial with Whoop. Come join the team. Let's level up together.
Welcome back to another episode of the Basketball and Barbells podcast. I'm your host, Xavier Brown. Today, we actually have a special guest, someone that I've actually wanted to get on the podcast for some time. He's been on a couple podcasts with different people, some of my friends. Today, we have Yuri Pagel, who is actually the performance coach over in the Netherlands for the national team over there. He's done some great work, written some great articles I'm going to link in the description. Yuri, I wanted to get the opportunity to introduce yourself, but I just want to say thank you, first and foremost, for coming on the podcast today, man.
Yeah, first of all, thank you for having me on. I know it's pretty late out there, so I don't want to hold you back from getting into bed too much, but it's an honor to be on here. You've had some great names on there, and blessed to be a part of those. I'm Yuri, 28 years old. I'm from Amsterdam. I work with the national basketball team, the national 3-on-3 basketball teams here. And besides that, I work as also performance coach for AFC Ajax, which is the soccer club over here. Reason being, basketball, although European basketball is pretty big in certain spots, there are also spots where it isn't large or full-time oriented, especially from a strength and conditioning perspective. So soccer is, so I work a dual role basically in soccer and in football at the moment.
Right. And I wanted to actually ask you, because, you know, obviously like basketball has become such a more popularized sport, was that, again, like I know you kind of like touched on it a little bit, but just like getting into basketball, like with the increase in popularity, you know, what was that kind of like maybe like in overseas where you've kind of experienced like, you know, maybe basketball was popular, but now it's just such a global sport that, you know, it's a sport that everyone is loving and is trying to get into.
Oh man, it's changed a lot. I want to say I started playing basketball myself when I was about 12 years old, so 16 years ago. So right around that, I want to say the first year I really got into basketball was the 81-point game year, so that's 2006. And like, I remember Kobe scored 62 on the Mavs, right, in the three-quarter game.
Yeah.
That was like late December 2005 or something. And I remember reading about it in the newspaper. Like, it had this little segment in the newspaper where I could see it. But other than that, like, it wasn't really seen here. Like, you didn't really get that much information out of it unless you were already fully embedded into, like, basketball culture and you were online, all that kind of stuff. But I was, you know, I was a young kid, so I didn't really know where to look. And I remember seeing that in the newspaper. And that was, like, there really wasn't any coverage here. The only coverage you'd have would be, I don't even know if NBA League Pass even existed back then in Europe. I don't think so. So like you'd have to look up YouTube videos of players. And maybe what I would do is I would grab my phone, I would screen record them and then go out to the basketball court, look at the videos and then try to emulate them horribly. But and now looking now, like it's all over TV. If I'm working with the AX players, like they all follow the NBA, they all know the NBA, they all know the players, they all try to do their moves even worse than I did when I was younger. So it's the growth in popularity has been immense. It's been huge, but Holland itself is not really a basketball country for some reason. I don't know why. But with that said though, for instance, so the Dutch national team qualified for the European Championships this week for the second time since 1988. So you can definitely see an increase likely through because of popularity resulting now in results. So that's pretty cool.
Right, right. And even just, yeah, like you said, like just the explosion, like you said, I mean, there, I remember being in high school and I would get on like NBA.com and I was in like computer class and I would just watch NBA highlights. And now obviously with the explosion of social media, it's almost like, you know, especially with quarantine and COVID, when the NBA shut down, it was almost like the world stopped. Like, you know, at that point, the world, you know, the virus had been, you know, spreading, but it was almost like once the NBA shut down, that's when I feel like the world kind of realized how serious it was. Like, as weird as it is to say, like it's the NBA, it's not necessarily like, you know, world organization, but it was just like watching that happen, I'm like, oh shit. It pretty was.
Now it's serious. Yeah, I know. I think a lot of people had that that kind of feeling for sure.
Right. Absolutely. Definitely want to touch a little bit more into your background, man. So I kind of touched on this off air, but you know, I heard a little bit more about your background where you studied business economics and then you got into performance training. Can you touch on that a little bit and how that transition happened or what chance you got that allowed you to be in the gym and start, you know, taking this craft more seriously?
Yeah, for sure. I think the big thing is, so I always played basketball when I was younger and I was straight garbage. Like I wasn't good at all. I was unathletic and unskilled, and now I'm reasonably athletic and still unskilled. So there still isn't much, but basketball was always the big passion. And I think I started training for it from a strength and conditioning perspective around age 15 or 16. And again, I would go to YouTube. I would watch videos of, I remember Kobe lifting and Mike lifting. And I would just look at the videos, screen record them, go to the gym and do the same exact exercises. Now, disclaimer, we can talk about later why that's a horrible idea. And please don't ever do that. But, you know, it kind of got me engaged into that whole thing. Because I love the way that the weight room was honest, right? If you worked hard, you'd get better. People that didn't work hard didn't get better. And that just felt fair to me. While on the other hand, if you play basketball, those that work hardest definitely are not always the ones that succeed. So I really started loving the weight room and what it stood for. But when I graduated high school, I didn't see or think that a career in performance or in sport performance, strength conditioning, whatever, I didn't think that was anything that was realistic. Because over here from a university perspective, although there are degrees that lean towards that field, they aren't specifically guided towards strength and conditioning. So for instance, we have movement sciences, but the study itself isn't very practical towards strength and conditioning. So at that point, not being able to understand. That'll always just be a hobby. School. I did that at the University of Cincinnati. So I moved to Cincinnati to start there. Had to come back, finish here in Amsterdam. And when I got back here, I kind of lost my passion for basketball for a while. So I didn't really want to play here. And I think for a year, I was just in the weight room, but I lost the competitive spirit. Like that's the biggest thing you miss about sports, right? It's just being able to compete. And, you know, I kind of miss that. So I remember I got into CrossFit personally. Mm-hmm. And at that time, that was perfect because it was so competitive. And that just, it lit a fire underneath me. And that for some reason was something that I was actually very talented at. So while I was doing my my studies in business, I actually got you know, decently good at CrossFit. And that basically took all my time away from my studies. And because I was so engaged into that whole process of training, I started reading about it, learning about it so much more and more and more to optimize my own performance, because CrossFit is a relatively simple sport. And it's all about physical enhancement. Like, of course, you know, fantastic mental capabilities in order to be able to take excruciating pain and keep going. But right. Generally, it's a very simple sport that's about the physical aspect. So I wanted to learn about it to get better. And from that, basically what happened is I just started helping people in the gym. Like, I would see movement patterns. Like, if you're not moving efficiently, you're going to lose. Because if you make 50 squats and the other does it too, but you're not moving efficiently, that person's probably going to win. So you got to have every single you got to basically squeeze every little bit of juice out of that movement efficiency part from a weight room perspective. So I would see people not move efficiently and immediately kind of hop on and try to help them. And that expanded and expanded until the gym that I trained at personally, they were like, okay, do you want to do an internship here? I was like, yeah, of course. Fantastic. Like, it was way more fun than business. I still didn't think it was going to be a career, but I was like, all right, cool. Let me do it on the side. And then my last year in college, I was just like, okay, screw this, like screw my grades. I'll just make sure I at least get my degree and I'm going to go into training. And I was training, I think, you know, in the personal training realm for about 2 years. And that's when I got my first gig working in sport. So I had worked with weightlifters up to that point. I'd worked with CrossFitters, powerlifters. So basically all the steel-based sports. Again, very relatively simple sports to work with. But at that point, I got my first opportunity to work in basketball. So that kind of pulled me back and it brought everything full circle. So there's a professional team here that plays in the Dutch National League, basically, and that's Apollo Amsterdam. Now, they're a professional squad, but relatively semi-professional. They have some players that are paid, some that aren't. But the thing is, they didn't have a strength and conditioning coach. And so the gym I worked at, they were going to sponsor the team. And as a result, I would become their head of strength and conditioning, which technically is an unpaid internship without a boss. So, you know, but it was fantastic because it got me an opportunity to, one, use all the weight room knowledge that I'd gathered over the years, combine that with the basketball knowledge, and work with the type of population or people that I wanted to work with. Because one thing I did realize when I started working in training or in the fitness industry was general population wasn't going to be what's going to make me happy in the long run. I knew that from the beginning. So being able to get back to sports was like my first step there. And so that was the thing with Apollo Amsterdam. And I had that for a couple of years, grew from there to a bigger club that played European ball here in Holland. That resulted in the two national teams on the side, because like I said, it's not huge, the sport over here. So when your name gets out there, it gets out there quickly. And so before you know it, you have three different jobs in basketball.
right.
I even remember when I went to that other Dutch club that played European ball, they also play in the same league as the team in Amsterdam. And I said to them, well, I believe it was like right at the start of the season when they approached me, and I had an interview with the owner, and I told the owner, I was like, well, but I can't stop with the team in Amsterdam now. Like, you know, I feel loyal to them. I have to finish their season. And he literally said, yeah, I know we play against them, but I don't see them as competition. So you can easily do both. That was pretty funny. So from there I had the two national teams. Those are part-time, of course, because, you know, the national team you don't see very often. The three-on-three team you do because they play year-round together. And there, 2 years ago, I want to say, no, yeah, this is my second year. I got approached by AFC IX, which is a soccer club here. It's been a whirlwind. It's been a lot of fun. It's been crazy. And if there's one thing, one common denominator about everything I've seen so far, it is that I've not been able to foresee anything that was going to happen, even remotely close.
Right. And one thing that sticks out with me is, even just like you explained, it was like an unpaid internship, like, right, no boss. But I think the biggest thing behind that was just the experience. I think a lot of, you know, I was very lucky to get experience super early. And like, you know, we're both pretty much the same age. I'm 27, you're 28. And I'm able to be blessed enough to work with some pro athletes and overseas players. And then people ask me, hey, like, how are you able to, you know, basically get to where you, you know, in your position? And it's kind of similar to your position as you, right? Like just getting the experience and then your name traveling and then people coming to see what the, you know, what's going on. But I feel like that was, you know, that's one thing that I've noticed in my career is just the experience. Like you can't learn some of this stuff in a book, right? Like it's the perfect scenarios are not going to pop up as the book, you know, may describe, right? Like if you've got 50 athletes in the gym and, you know, you've got to train all of them at one time, like, are you going to be able to get a quality session in? Like, they're probably not, but you kind of learn to think on your feet pretty quickly. But no, I think that's an amazing story, man. Just kind of going from business and even you kind of sitting down and saying, hey, like, screw the grades. Like, let's just make sure you get the degree because the experience, I think, is invaluable, man, for sure.
Oh, I mean, I think that's the biggest thing, to be honest. I think if there's one thing I dislike about the system that most strength and conditioning coaches are being developed is you go from college, right? You get a graduate assistant job somewhere and then generally go to be an assistant somewhere else. And then all of a sudden you progress into being a head of strength and conditioning. What I see in most situations for the ones that are graduate assistants or assistants is that they don't have the autonomy to write programs or execute them. So you are basically doing something that someone else is telling you to do, which there's nothing wrong with that. But if you take that step and then you become a head strength and conditioning coach without having been able to make mistakes yourself, and then you're already put in this high stakes situation, I don't think you're necessarily set up for success, if that makes sense. So what I loved is, for instance, I started working in basketball and I figured, oh, now I'm working with athletes. These guys are going to move fantastically. It's going to be amazing. The coaching is going to be easy. And you get into that situation and you realize some of these guys move worse than 80% of the GPP crowd have been working. And it's like, you could have never envisioned, you think a pro athlete must be able to do this right. And they have a hard time learning movements or they're incapable of certain movements, like all this kind of stuff. You don't really see. Or for the other hand, when I started off my career, I also did CrossFit classes. I had to get 30 people to do the same thing that I wanted them to do after a long day of work or whatever they've been doing, everything in their life. You know, they tend to be unfocused and all over the place. And then you start working with 15 players in basketball. You're like, this is easy. That's easy to get you guys to do the same thing. If I can get 30 people that don't even want to train, and I compare it to 15 people that are, you know, not all of them want to train, but at least the majority wants to train, it's going to be a little bit easier to get everyone to do what you want them to do. So like getting all that experience, being able to see all those different kind of people, work with different people. And the big thing to me is make fucking mistakes. Like that's the big thing to me. So if I did 20 group classes or the thing I had with CrossFit in the very beginning, what I thought was cool is like you would have the same class five or six hours in a row. What that does is my first class, you know, you might be a little bit, things might not be running smoothly. And by the time you've done it five or six times, you know exactly where you have to stand in order to be able to see what everyone's doing, in order to be able to pay attention to everyone. All those different factors that have influence on whether your training session at that point is going to be successful. I think that's huge, is getting all those different things in instead of always having to assist someone else and never truly making the process your own until you are in a high stakes environment, if that makes sense.
It does. No, I think in my upbringing and kind of getting into the game was similar to yours, right? Like I kind of touched on, but it's important, like you said, to make mistakes, to have the autonomy to go out there and, you know, there's some things you just have to learn on the job, right? There, you know, there's things we can read articles, we can, you know, listen to podcasts, but getting thrown in the fire, there's nothing like it. And yeah. I agree with you. I actually never got, you know, I had an internship, but I actually never had, you know, a graduate assistantship, tried to get one. It's so funny because I got hired as, you know, a strength and conditioning coach at this school in Ohio. And it was me and one other coach, and it was just us two for like 500 athletes. And because of that, you know, we made a ton of mistakes. Don't get me wrong. but we had no one over us. Like, we got the final say so for my teams, right? He had his teams, but I was able to, at the age of like 24 or 25, you know, basically just kind of do my own thing and have an entire program, have like 5, 6, 7 teams. And again, like, not everyone gets that experience, but again, like you said, like, by the time like you're running the first session, like, it's going to be sloppy, you know, things happen. And then, like you said, you clean it up. But again, like, I think, and, you know, don't get me wrong, like, I think there's still value in having a mentor for sure, but there has to be some give and take, like the compromise. Hey, like, let him off the leash a little bit. I forgot who said, I think it was Gilbert Arenas, but he's like, no one's scared of a pit bull on the leash, right? Like, everyone's afraid of the pit bull that gets loose. But I totally agree, man, for sure.
Yeah, and like you said, though, there, I mean, having a mentor is immensely important and valuable, but I think it's more important and more valuable if they guide you through the process of you being able to learn on the job instead of you just looking at them. I think that's a big thing. And I mean, Gilbert Arenas hits it right on the spot. That's a funny dude, by the way. That's a funny ass dude.
Bro, I love Gilbert. Shout out to Gilbert, man. But he's always, you know, I listen to his podcast, and he's got some great insight. I think he would be a dope trainer. He would be a dope, possibly even a coach. I don't know. He kind of likes to act up, man. I don't know if he can be suited for that coach role.
Yeah, but I don't know if he can do that. But training, he does hate the weight room, though. He is one of those typical ones that hates the weight room.
Right. And it's funny, man. Like, this kind of, I agree, kind of like a quick little question. You know, obviously in your experience, like, you've seen, like, you even touched on it, basketball players do not like the weight room. Like, I don't know, you know, what it is. And it's also the culture, right? You know, we have football players, we have football teams where they live in the weight room, right? Because it's a physical sport. And when you get into football, that's just part of it. Like, you're going to hit the weight. But basketball, you know, you can get by without touching the weight until pretty much college, right? And even then, like, you know, we have some programs in high school where they'll touch and go with weights. But I don't know, unless you're a powerhouse, you're not necessarily going to take it too seriously. But how are you able to get some buy-in from your players? Like, I know you touched on, like, again, like, some players are just like, oh, I just want to do this. Like, how are you able to get that athlete, look them in the eye, and like, hey, like, this is important, this is why it's important, you know? And how are you able to get them to say, oh, shit, like, this is actually important, and buy into what you were telling them?
Yeah, I think one, before going into anything else, it's being able to develop personal relationships with people. That, of course, depends on how much time you're able to spend with them, how long you're going to be with them in total, and all that kind of stuff. But being able to build a relationship and understanding the human being that's in front of you, I think, is going to be key number 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way to 5,000 before we discuss anything else. Right. If you don't understand the person you're working with, if you don't understand what drives them, because, you know, I have athletes that literally say, I want to do the least amount of things I can possibly do and still make it. Okay, well, that's their mindset, you know. And then there's the others that are just going to want to grind all day. You're going to have to pull back. So it's I think immensely important that we understand who we are working with when we are working with them. And that is understanding the person or the human being that's behind the athlete. Because when I started working in basketball, I was kind of, I don't know. I, on one hand, I was surprised. On the other hand, I wasn't surprised by the lack of interest in training for basketball, for strength conditioning. And I think that also comes because of my own passion for it. So I was so energetic and passionate. And I was like, okay, come on, guys, let's go. We're going to do this and that. And they were all like, yo, calm the fuck down. Like, chill. And so I don't know if I was necessarily surprised by them, or that it was my own perspective that, or how passionate I was, that kind of clouded my judgment over how other people view strength and conditioning, right? Because a lot of people are like, oh, that's working. Because I think if you look at it simply, you realize basketball is a game. They're playing a game. They love playing that game, but they don't love training. Training is different. Like, they don't like running up and down the court for conditioning. They don't like to do weights because that's not a game. That's hard. It's not fun. Except for the psychotic ones that actually enjoy that kind of stuff, right? but the majority probably isn't going to look at it that way. So when I started looking at it that way, okay, so maybe they don't see it as highly enjoyable. Now, how am I going to approach them in general, but also on an individual perspective? How am I going to approach them and make sure I can still motivate them and engage them in the process? And one of the biggest things for me personally has become making them understand, one, why we're doing things, and then making them part of the process. So especially with the ones that are a little bit more intelligent, a little bit more aware, I can make them understand certain things. I can make them feel certain things. So for instance, you know, you might be able to say like, okay, you want to jump higher, right? Like, or let's say beginning of the season, what's your goal? Okay, my goal is to jump higher. Whether that is something we should strive for in season or not, that's a different subject. So, but for right now, let's say your goal is to jump higher. All right, okay, what do you think you need to be doing in order to jump higher? Well, I think this and this and this. And then I, you know, with my opinion, my professional opinion, then I could say, okay, I think we're going to probably need to do this in order to get there. Is that something that you're going to be able to invest in order to see those results? And if at that point they say yes, then you can use that against them. You can hold it against them whenever they're slacking and they're not doing what you want them to, what they need to be doing in order to accomplish that goal, if that makes sense. You're using their own motivation and what they find important to kind of find a middle road or a path to success where you both are becoming more and more integrated into the process instead of you basically determining the process. And like you said, or like Gil said, them just staying on the leash. I would much rather, especially if I work with athletes for a longer period of time, that it is us working together towards something than me having to growl at you and telling you what to do the entire time, but you not wanting to do it. Because if there's one thing I have learned also over the years, it is that if athletes don't want to do something, they will not do it with intent. And if they don't do it with intent, just stay home. Like I have seen the most worst results, even if they train 5 times a week, do this, do that. If they don't believe in it, if they don't have some kind of focused energy when they are performing the work, you're going to get very little out of it. And then my question is, are we really spending our energy wisely? So trying to incorporate them into the process, making the process theirs as much as it is mine, I think that is one of my personal bigger ways of trying to get that buy-in, because it makes them understand.
Right. That's beautiful. That's the way you just articulated that. And like you said, like it all starts with one, you got to know who you're working with, right? Investing in that relationship. I think part of that obviously is, you know, getting to know each other and then, you know, them having that trust level with you. But even then, you just sitting down and saying, hey, like, what's your goal? Like understanding their goals. And then, like you said, just using it against them, not because, you know, we want to, you know, tear them down, but we have to use that as a source of motivation as well. I think that's definitely important. And I'm not sure how much you follow into Corey Schlesinger, but one thing that he talked about was like the autonomy, right, of the athlete, like getting them to buy in. And one thing he did that I've, you know, kind of came across was, and I'm not sure, I actually kind of want to ask your thoughts on this, like he would actually create, you know, like the training menu, right? And this is something I kind of thought about for myself, but he would have the athlete, okay, what's the goal, you know, blah, blah, blah. But then sit down and say, hey, these are the exercises, you know, a selection, maybe 2 or 3, like maybe for like a warm up, you know, maybe a main lift, and then having some accessories, and then, you know, finisher, whatever the case is. But if he would actually have the athletes over time as they understood what he was trying to have them do, basically kind of, I would say almost like choose your own adventure. And I felt like it was such a different way of training athletes, because like you said, like we're so used to strength and conditioning is like military, right? It's almost like do this at this time, this many reps. And I found that very interesting, because now you're putting more power in the athlete's hands. And now they have to have some responsibility over what it is they're getting out of it. So I kind of want to touch on that and say, like, personally, I think that's a, you know, a different take, but I respect it for sure. Do you feel like you would be able to, in a situation like over time, like kind of give a little bit more power to the athlete that way?
Yeah, for sure. I think I definitely do it I've heard of how Corey does it, and I think there's a lot of similarities between the way he and I attack things. For me, again, that also comes back to the learning process. So I will, for instance, we'll have a lower body day or we'll have a heavier lower body lift. And I will just ask the athletes, or I will give them two or three options and I'll put it on the board. And then I say, okay, you choose. And then they'll be like, okay, but which one should I choose? I was like, which one will you choose? And that kind of becomes like a fun little back and forth where I make them understand the differences between certain lifts, why they're picking certain lifts. And of course, there is a slight disclaimer here. Like if you notice that an athlete specifically needs one thing over the other, of course you're going to get that in. Mm-hmm. But in a, you know, kind of an arbitrary situation where it really doesn't matter. Okay, let's say we're using a pin squat versus a trap bar deadlift. Then I will let the athlete have autonomy in that situation. So some athletes don't like squatting, but they do enjoy trap bar deadlifting. If I can get them into similar joint positions and at similar loads, but they are enjoying one lift versus the other one, which they don't like, then I will 99 out of 100 times make them do the thing that they actually enjoy doing. Like I don't see the point in having them do the lift that they're not having fun doing and there's no intent. And the next time they come in the gym, they see the pin squat on the board. They're like, oh, fuck you, Yuri. I don't want to do this. So I really agree there with Corey. I think I do it very similarly. I want them to have autonomy as long as they are responsible enough to handle the autonomy. There will be phases during the season where I take the autonomy away from most players. Because I feel like at that point, it's very, very important that they get a very detailed load in. And that has to come from my end. But there also will be phases where I will definitely let them go a lot more and teach them more about the training process. Because there's always one thing I tell these players, which is the highly characteristic of European basketball or also for soccer, is I will not spend a long time with you in the long run. Like the odds that we're going to be spending 2+ years together are slim to none. The odds that we're going to be together for 5+ years are zero. Like that basically doesn't happen. So if I know I might have you for 1 or 2 years, the big thing I want to do is to lay groundwork and a foundation for you to be able to train and understand kind of, at least to a certain extent, what training is and what it should look like for the rest of your career. I think that is largely more valuable than if maybe I used an exercise specifically while they, so that they jumped 1% higher. I would much rather not have that percent higher, but have them understand the training process so that maybe they can have 5% more over the next few years, even if that's not under my guidance. But at least I've laid that foundation. So I think that's largely also a reason why I focus so much on autonomy already early in the process. While maybe if I had a 4-year project, you know, if I were to work in college, maybe I would guide a little bit more into that autonomy. I now already start doing it a little bit faster because I want to speed up that process of them understanding what it looks like or what it feels like, if that makes sense again.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it's more so just even, you know, touching on Corey, because one, like I said, I agree. I think Corey's brilliant. I think even when he talks about it, what you just kind of hinted at is chasing an adaptation. Not necessarily chasing a specific exercise. And again, like there's going to be those instances where, you know, the athlete is going to have to be responsible enough because you can't just give it to every athlete because some athletes going to cut corners, you know, fifth and a third. And so maybe you just got to make them earn it over the time or over long periods of time. But I kind of want to, because you kind of brought up a point, you may not have the athletes that long, right? Like a year, 2 years. I'm in the same boat, right? I may not even have an athlete for very long. I may be less than a year. And I want to touch on specifically, we talked about it, but even just the article about Olympic lifting. And, you know, it's always a, I don't want to say debate, but it's always an interesting conversation when they come to me saying, hey, should basketball players Olympic lift? Obviously because of technicalities of time, the learning curve. But I wanted to talk to you about how you were able to implement it in a couple different scenarios. So one, I know you find value in the Olympic lift. You don't sway either way, right? They can be useful, you know, in a certain context. But when you have an athlete who you don't have much time with, how do you implement Olympic lifting? And if so, or if not, are you implementing variations of the Olympic lift?
I think you hit the nail right the hit there is saying context, right? Like that's the big thing. I do have a very large background in Olympic lifting for me personally, but also the athletes I've worked with. I've worked with European championship level weightlifters. Like I've definitely seen that side of the spectrum. And so when I started working in basketball, like I said, I didn't work with athletes besides CrossFit weightlifting and powerlifting. So what happens when you then get your first job in sports? And of course you're going to be doing the three lifts. So you're going to be bench squatting and deadlifting, and you're going to be doing cleans and snatches. And what I kind of noticed, and like we discussed at the beginning of the talk, is, you know, you're able to make mistakes. And what I saw is like, okay, I'm seeing these guys two times a week, and I have about an hour, and I am spending roughly 30 minutes of it doing weightlifting. And every time I'm like, I'm not really able to do much more, because in order for weightlifting to be an effective tool, in order for you to be able to get the value out of weightlifting, there needs to be a base level of technical competency. And how high that technical competency is or needs to be, I think that is also a large discussion point where people disagree. I think it is much higher than what I generally will see in strength and conditioning. Not a knock to anyone specifically, but if I look at 80% of cleans or snatches that are being done in college, I turn over and throw up. I think it's horrible. I think there is far too much risk attached to some of those mechanics if you look at them. I could go into those in more detail. I kind of do a little bit in the article you just mentioned. But so like I said, we need to have a base of technical proficiency or competency in the lifts. Now, the lifts relatively for other weight room means are far more skill demanding than, let's say, a squat or a bench or a deadlift or, you know, some of these other lifts. So it takes more time to teach. Now, maybe we can get a lot out of it. Absolutely. I fully think we can. But the time we have to spend in order to get that value in most of the situations I found myself personally in is too much. So if I need to spend half the time in order to get them to a certain level, in order to then be able to use the tool to gain, I don't know, let's say vertical power expression or something like that, then that's not worth it to me. Because if I start the season with a group of athletes, generally in Europe, you won't. So let's say from a pro club, a club perspective here, you get the guys right before training camp. So you don't have an off season. So you're basically already in a situation where, you know, the players are immediately going to be run into the ground because, you know, head coaches, you know how that goes. So they immediately start doing conditioning, doing basketball, this and that. And then after a month, you're already in season. Then you're playing in season for about 7-8 months and they go to a different team. So let's say I'm in total looking at 9 months with a player, of which none of that is off season, of which out of those 12 to 15 players, they all have various different backgrounds. Some might be coming from college. Some might be coming from an academy here. Some might have already been in Europe for 6 or 7 years and they're now in this situation. So you have a vastly different population of athletes you're working with vastly different needs. So if I then say, okay, we're all going to snatch, we're all going to clean, you're going to see older athletes that have developed certain movement patterns that are not ideal for lifting, or maybe have injury histories so that they don't have the required positions they need to get in to be able to lift safely. Let's say they lack shoulder flexion or wrist extension, so they can't catch clean, this and that. If I have all of those different populations with all the restrictions that each individual might have, it's going to be very hard for me to teach those lifts and be able to get out of it when I want to get out of it. So, you know, in those situations, it's just very unlogical for me to be like, okay, I'm going to invest this time into weightlifting in order to drive the adaptation that I want to see. Because that's a big thing to me, is right, it's a certain adaptation. I want to adapt to something. Okay. If I want to adapt, if I use the Olympic lifts, what's the adaptation I want to see? Now, again, multiple different things. Let's now zone into vertical power, all right? Just for sake of argument or simplicity. Let's say it's vertical power. Okay, what other tools are going to help me drive that same adaptation? Okay, I could look at it from a maximal strength perspective, right? I could say, Well, I could get them stronger, which then in some cases, especially the ones that are a little bit weaker relative to their own body weight, they might be able to increase their power by increasing max strength. That could be a thing we could do, right? We can still lift decently heavy or lift heavy enough in order to get strength gains in season without it really interfering with what's happening on the court if we plan it appropriately. So I could do stuff like that. All right, what else could we do? Well, we could do other ballistic exercises, which might be simpler. So let's say we can do loaded jumps. Fantastic. You can put in trap bar jumps, dumbbell jumps, this and that. Then you're like, okay, that could work. But if we're working in season and we already have a huge jump volume or plyometric volume on court, maybe we should be a little bit more careful about when we're using this, but it might be another tool and it's gonna take much less time away from us. Okay, fantastic. So that could be another one. All right, now what if I don't want to work ballistically because of the impact, right? Consider jumping, you also have to land. So what if I want that ballistic intent at higher velocities? Well, maybe I go squatting at lower load, but we're going to go band resistant. So we still have that ballistic intent, but we're not actually turning the movement into a ballistic because we're staying on the ground. That could be another way of attacking this and maybe more suitable for an in-season phase than frequently doing loaded jumps. All right. So we have three different things we could try here. What else could we do? Well, the full Olympic lifts are very difficult to teach, in my opinion. But there are derivatives of the Olympic lifts that we can also use. We can say, okay, instead of doing a power clean, maybe we do a jump shrug or a clean pull, right? Maybe we are taking a trap bar instead of a barbell because then it's even easier to do. And we're going to do a trap bar clean pull instead of using a straight bar because it's easier to use and even easier to teach. Maybe that takes 15 minutes. While a clean pull could take a session or longer, or, you know, just as an example. So I could use a trap bar and go there for a clean pull. Again, now I'm not turning this into a ballistic, so there's likely a little bit less impact, especially if I drop the bar instead of catching on the eccentric. But it's much easier to teach, and it likely drives a similar adaptation. Now, from my experience, all of these tools could work fantastically, and you could look at the research and say, oh, okay, you know, if I do loaded jumps, I'm likely going to have better effect than if I do cleans or the other way around and this and that. And you can state that. From my personal experience, I do think the Olympic lifts are some of these most effective tools out there, meaning if you are good at the Olympic lifts, they will make you strong, they will make you explosive, they will make you this and that. But the requirements in order to be able to get there, so the efficiency of the process, how much time and energy and resources does it take, that in a lot of situations doesn't make it worth for me to invest those resources into Olympic weightlifting. And this is basically, in a nutshell, what I described in that article for Mladen Jovanovic. It just comes down to me, like, as a strength and conditioning coach, you want to have a big toolbox, very large toolbox of different things you can use in certain situations. So if you only have a hammer to your availability, everything's going to look like a nail. But if I have 10 different tools, I can utilize them and see, oh, all right, I'm trying to, well, this is a nail. Should I use a screwdriver? Okay, maybe not, right? If I want to paint the walls, am I going to use the hammer? Yeah, maybe I'll make that mistake once, but probably not twice. the more tools you develop, the more you start to understand where they might be useful and where they might not fit the context. And for me, Olympic weightlifting, fantastic tool, but generally it doesn't fit the context of the situations I have personally found myself in. But if, let's say, you have a 4-year project in college and you have enough hours with the athletes, then maybe long run, again, we're thinking about the bigger picture, maybe if you teach them adequately, they can give you a lot towards the latter years in college. So that could be a totally different situation. I'm just speaking about my context and the situations I've personally found myself in.
Right. No, that was beautifully articulated. I think the main thing is funny because, like, as you were speaking, I kind of touched back on this, but even just, like, again, not to harp on it, but just the phrase chasing the adaptation, like you said, like there are multiple ways to chase different adaptations, as you pointed out. But again, like you said, like the context matters. And I think even just touching on some of the exercises you named, I think even going back to the intent with the athletes, I think a big thing, like you talked about, which is making sure that one, like the athlete is always going to kind of think back to, I want to be safe in this lift, right? So when it does come to some of the Olympic lifts, like you said, the competencies and even the confidence, I think that matters as well. So like, are they confident going into lift? They're not confident, they're not going to have that intent because they're worried about, oh, like, you know, making a mistake, getting hurt. And that's just going to come with years of experience of getting that confidence. Like you said, like there's resources and there's time, there's an investment into the Olympic lift. But I think like you just touched on, like it's one thing to go into like a clean, but it's also another thing to go into, like you said, a trap bar clean, right? So you're still able to teach that in 15 minutes and the athlete's like, oh, okay, I don't feel as if this is very complicated, very complex. They're going to have more confidence. You're going to get more intent out of it. But I 100% agree, man. It's like you said, you just got to have tools in the toolbox, right? Like if you're in a specific situation and you only have, like you said, just a hammer, right? Well, you're not going to come out of that project looking pretty, right? You're going to force a lot of odd objects into odd spaces that don't necessarily need to fit. And I think it just comes with, again, experience with coaches, kind of talking back and, you know, bringing up what we spoke about, just getting in the trenches and learning. But I think it was really important because I never had that background of Olympic lifting. It was introduced to me, but that was later on in my actual career, right? As I got started, my mentor was a PT. He was a physical therapist. So I kind of learned a lot of prehab first, then kind of learned more into the conjugate style, West Side barbell methods, more Olympic lifts. So I was learning a bunch of different things at once, or not at once, but just over my career. That way, once I was getting this experience actually training and coaching, right, I was able to kind of pull from different areas. But I didn't even consciously think about this until later on in my career, like, wow, you know, I was blessed enough to get different experiences. So like you just touched on, I get in a situation where these basketball players, like you said, they don't want to lift, damn sure don't want to do any Olympic lifting for the most part in my experience. So I was able to kind of pull different things and still get the adaptations. But no, I think that was amazing the way you articulated that, because again, like you said, context matters and just having different tools for different situations.
Yeah, and it kind of also goes back to the autonomy thing and Corey and what we discussed earlier is if I come across a player that has 4 years of weightlifting experience in college and they personally live and die by the lifts and they're like, yeah, this is what made me explosive and all that kind of stuff. Like, I am more than happy to implement them for them. Mm-hmm. Like that's what they enjoy doing. That's what they've been doing. That's what's going to keep them happy in the weight room. So then I don't have any problem putting it in. But if on the other hand, like you said, if I look at my own experience with basketball, the vast majority does not want to do Olympic lifts. And right. I think that's also like, if you have a basketball player and you're doing cleans with them and maybe they don't have the requirements or the movement requirements to be able to perform them efficiently, like let's say going back to that shoulder flexion thing, if you don't have the appropriate shoulder flexion or thoracic extension or wrist extension, that is going to result likely in a lot of banging on the wrist, right? The wrist is probably going to take the majority of the blame for the lack of mobility in these other joints. Now, working with basketball players, if they feel their wrist on two subsequent lifts, they are not going to want to be able to do it again, because that wrist is basically like the end of the most fluid motion they can ever do, which is shooting. So they're not going to be a fan of a movement that hurts on their wrist. Now, again, if someone has the adequate movement patterns, then, you know, you should not have any wrist pain doing cleans or snatches. But let's be honest, most athletes you're going to see, they're not going to be that way. So I think if they like doing it, I'll definitely use it with them. If I have the time, I'll use it with them. But if I don't, then it's just another tool and I'll go back into the toolbox and look for something else and hopefully find a better solution, like you said, to drive the adaptation that we want while putting them in a long-term situation to succeed and improve. That's it.
Right. Absolutely, man. Absolutely. All right, man. Final kind of topic before we wrap this up. I definitely wanted to touch on this because you brought it up earlier and I thought it was such a good point that I wrote it down because I want to come back to it. But social media, right? I get a ton of athletes that, one, you know, I post on social media. If they come to me asking me questions, you're big on social media, post a lot of great, amazing content. What, I don't know how to ask the question, but what are your thoughts on the general state right now of social media and trainers? Like, I know there's going to be some good stuff out there. There's going to be some bad stuff out there. What are your thoughts on athletes kind of fishing through social media, maybe trying to find exercises, maybe trying to find answers? Is there higher quality content out there? If so, where is it? Or should they just not even use social media whatsoever? Like, what are your thoughts on that?
That's a tough question. I mean, just like anything, you're going to have the good, the bad, and the fucking ugly. same on social media for sure. And I mean, that's the day and age of now, right? I mean, anybody can put anything online and it's instantly visible. And it is much easier to generate bullshit than it is to fight it. So if you see some of the accounts on social media that have a huge following, let's say hundreds of thousands of followers, the likelihood that person or account actually puts out quality content that isn't a shiny object that's just made pretty for the public, but it really doesn't maybe convey the right message. The odds that an account that big actually serves the public is pretty small, I think, generally. I think if you want to grow large on social media, like really large, generally you kind of have to spew out a little bit more bullshit. That's not saying that that's always going to be the case, but it often is. Because if it doesn't look sexy, if it doesn't look fancy, like I said, if it isn't a shiny little object, then people aren't going to be engaged, because social media is made to have a click as fast as possible. You want everything to be as fast as possible. And what Instagram basically wants is it wants you to create content that makes people stop, look, and say on Instagram. So if you're putting out a large text with context, that's not made for social media, or especially not made for Instagram, because Instagram is made for quick, like, share, comment, all that kind of stuff. What is, it is fancy looking exercises that look like sports. Those exercises, people are gonna be like, oh, that looks cool, let me share this. And that's how an account grows and grows and grows, because, you know, the algorithms are gonna, they look down favorably upon amongst those kind of things. So mm-hmm. If you wanna grow, you really have to put all those fancy little things in there. And I think there really isn't that much wrong with it, because it is up to the person viewing the information, taking the information in. It is up to them to be able to understand whether it is usable in their situation. So I think it's kind of tough, because on one hand you want to say like, oh yeah, you know, the person that has to, that makes or shares the information is responsible for it. But then on the other hand, it is also the person that reads it or sees it or views it is just as responsible. But I don't think we can expect people on social media to be responsible enough about their own process and what they view, and to be able to see through bullshit and see what's good and see what isn't. So I think it is our duty personally as professionals in the strength and conditioning community or in sport performance itself, is our duty to put out correct information. And that doesn't mean you can't make mistakes and put something on there that you're later like, oh, that was wrong. But I think with the right intention. So the right intention should be to educate others, to improve their process and make it easier for them. That's kind of where I come from. It's like, okay, I've had people help me so much because of the things they put out or the things they teach me or taught me. I think it is kind of my responsibility to do the same. So all I do on social media, I just share my own process. If people like that, they do. If people don't, then they don't. Will I sometimes put out a dick comment because I think someone asked questions without even considering context? Yes, I'll do that too, because it fits my personality. But if you don't like it, you don't like it. That's fine. But I think the big thing is, for me personally, it's like I said, it is our duty to kind of put out the stuff where we think it is at least not bullshit. And I think some people on social media might not view it the same way, and they will spew out bullshit just for the sake of spewing out bullshit. that was a long rant though.
No, I love it, man. I agree with you though, man. Like, it's weird, right? Because on one hand, like you said, we want to make sure we're educating, we're still putting out, and you know, being as authentic as possible. And then on the other hand, like you said, like you're gonna have these big accounts where, again, like they're gonna post, you know, I'm not gonna say any names, but they're gonna post, you know, some stuff out there, and it's just like you said, it's different, right? And that's all social media is like. They don't want to see the same thing. They want to see something that's like, you know, gonna grab their attention. That's what social media is.
Yeah.
Like you said, was created for at this point now. All social media wants is your attention. We have ads. We're not gonna get into that, but it's to the point now where if you can grab someone's attention, okay, cool. Like you said, like, share, all that stuff, algorithm. So it does get messy at a point, because where do we draw the line of, you know, being authentic and then also depending on the business, trying to grow the business. And because of that, like you said, you got to put out bullshit, right? So yeah, man, I think it's such a weird place, because at the beginning, when I first got into social media, I was doing it just kind of spread and just share information. And then over time, you know, people would, you know, like, it's kind of, like you said, it's kind of comment and leave things and just saying like, you know, hey, like, you know, this is old. Like, why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing that? And, you know, it's just weird to me, because end of the day, like you said, whatever you put out, like, it's going to serve somebody, right? Like, it may not be the masses. It may not be, like you said, 300,000-500,000 people, but I think it's important that people kind of look inward and say, all right, what audience am I serving? Like, who needs this? For me, I just kind of look at basketball players come to me, ask me a ton of questions. So I create posts based off the question they ask me. Okay, cool. Like, you know, an ankle rehab or knee rehab. All right, here's some stuff that you can possibly do that I have through my experience. But yeah, man, I think, you know, it's kind of hard, you know, because players come to me, ask me what accounts they should follow. Should they just take stuff from my page, this page? And like you said, it's hard to answer, because I can make suggestions, but it's to the point where players, and not even just players, but just people in general, cherry pick the stuff they like and then try to create something from it. And that's, I think, where it gets really dangerous.
Yeah, I think that's big. And like you said, I always have a hard time answering that question too. I mean, same with like, you know, what kind of book should I be reading, or what kind of podcast I should be listening to? And I think the big thing comes down to you as an individual have to determine what your current weakness is in like your knowledge base, like where's the gaps in your knowledge that you want to personally fill. If that's for a strength and conditioning coach, it's going to be for his job. If that's for a basketball player, maybe it's to understand more about the training process, but you have certain knowledge gaps that apparently you want to fill. Then if I know that gap, then maybe I can send you in another direction. But if you just come up to me, you're like, what's the best training book out there? I'm like, well, I mean, you know, for one person that might be Super Training. For another, that might be some of Bondarchuk's work. But if you're a beginner, maybe that's Science and Practice of Strength Training by Satsuki. Like, you know, it totally depends on the situation. I mean, coming back to the whole context thing we've been talking about the entire hour now. but I mean, that's just simply how it is. Like, if I want to be able to help you, I have to understand slightly what your context is. So also with this question, like, you know, who should be following? Well, depends on who you are, depends on what you like, depends on what you use social media for. If you just do it for enjoyment and entertainment, well, some of those quote unquote bullshit clowns might be funny to follow. But other than that, it all comes down to context here too.
Right, man. It's almost like we don't want to make blanket statements and just say, oh, okay, like just do this, this and that. So like, I mean, it's just hilarious, because I'll get players that just DM me just like, how do I jump higher? I'm like, okay, like, come on, man. Like, you're not giving me anything. I don't know how old you are, bro. Like, what's your name? You know what I mean? And like, you know, joking about it, but like, I get that so commonly. It's to the point now where I'm just like, I'll say, hey, stop asking that question, right? Like, I don't have any, you guys aren't giving me anything. But yeah, man, context is king for sure. We need that. Yuri, I want to say I appreciate you for hopping on. I want the listeners, for those who've been under a rock, like, I want them to be able to find you, to be able to, you know, look at some of the content you've been posting, find all your other stuff that you've been putting out there. where can people find you, you know, whatever social media you want to give, you know, how can people reach out and follow your?
Yeah, so I am, you can find me most, like, I'm way behind my phone way too much. So, or on my phone way too much. So you can find me on Instagram at Yuri Pagel. That's YOERIPEGEL. So that's where I'm on mostly. I am a guest contributor for the CVASP website. So I wrote there a little bit, and I'll try to do that a little bit more to this year. So if you're a little bit more into the longer things to read instead of the social media posts, then you can find it on there. Other than that, this year I will be doing a presentation on optimizing the training process for basketball for a Strength Coach Network. So if you're a strength and conditioning or professional and you are on Strength Coach Network or thinking about it, I will be dropping a webinar on that and some of the things we discussed today and a little bit more on Strength Coach Network.
For sure, man. I'm definitely going to link that, you know, your IG and, you know, the work that you've been putting out. I'm actually excited for that webinar, man. I actually didn't know that. So now I got to tune in. That's news to me, for everyone listening.
It hasn't been released yet. I will record it this week, and then I'll discuss with Kier when it's going to drop it. It's been a lot of work, and it's been a lot of fun making it. So it kind of goes into, you know, some of the frequent questions I've personally had to ask myself over the years. So basically how those questions that I've asked myself and trying to find solutions to those questions on a bigger scale, but also specifically to the situations that I was in, how answering those questions have shaped my views on the training process for specifically for basketball up till this point in my life. So I think it kind of is a summation of all the brain farts I've had over the past couple of years.
All right. Nah, I got to tune in, man. But again, Yuri, I appreciate your time, man. Thank you so much. I know it's pretty early over there, so get your day started. Do what you got to do. But for all those listening, please go tap in with Yuri. He's got some great stuff. I've been following for a minute, and I'm just so happy I was able to actually get him on the podcast. Yuri, thank you again for tapping in with me. And I look forward to having you on again, man, for sure.
Hey, thanks for having me on, man. It's a great time. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Basketball and Barbells podcast. I really hope you all got major value from today's episode. Please leave a rating and review of the show, and don't forget to tune into the next episode.